Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The hour, it's Tuesday, it's the first day of November, a brand new month, as we wind down 2011. I'm Bob Kincaid, this is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network, otherwise known as Conversation Radio, radio unlike any other. Welcome aboard. I sure had fun with last night's Halloween program. I hope you did as well. And for those of you who might, I don't know if it got fixed yet or not, but I was notified late last night that the podcast was kind of squirrely. It dropped off in one place and picked up in another that was entirely different. And so I uploaded my copy to Ben Birch over at White Rose, and hopefully it will be corrected at some point in the very near future. If it hasn't been already, I haven't. I neglected to check. I'm a bad person. But rest assured, it will be corrected. And thanks to Maura and Betsy and others for letting me know that there was a problem with it. I do appreciate it when that sort of thing happens. Now, let's see. Program notes. Just a reminder, no show on Friday. I will be on the road. Everything else should be pretty much normal, though. Well, you know, with the caveat about normal. Thank you, Peter. Apart from that, yeah, we'll get through the week, and hopefully things won't be too squirrely for a while. We will have two Dr. Bill O'Brien, Professor Keith Lilly American History chats. They will both fall on Tuesdays, and this month. So look forward to those. I will tell you about those as we get a little bit more a little bit closer to them. I know that I am biased because I think the world and all of Dr. Bill O'Brien, he's one of the finest people I've ever known, but he's also one of the most intelligent people I've ever known. And for that reason, I recommend highly to you that you check out the Prism West Virginia American History series when it comes your way. And those, there will be two of those this month, and one in December, I believe. So, like I said, I'll let you know when they get near. Like I said, last night was a fun show. I'm being told by Texas Betsy that the podcast is still only 2 minutes long on iTunes. Don't know why. I will message Ben again and see if I can find out. Apparently there's something going sideways with the recording mechanism on Ben's end. And he will, as soon as he surfaces for air, because he is being worked like a bank mule, he will attend to those, I'm quite certain. No, like I said, last night was a lot of fun. Halloween is a lot of fun. Of course, today is the day after Halloween. It is, unless I miss my guess and I am culturally screwing up, this is La Dia de los Muertos. In Mesoamerica, is it not? And other parts of the Western Hemisphere South? Yeah, okay, thank you, Betsy. 2 hours, right. But it's still not complete. Now, this is a day for the remembering of those who have gone on before us. And I don't want to get grim or any... And even those celebrations are not grim. They are joyous. And it's a classic case culturally of an older culture not completely biting on the imprint or overlay of an imposed religion and maintaining elements of their own therein. In this case, the ancient religions of Mesoamerica and South America that had a calendric reference. Ah, El Día de los Muertos. Thank you, Betsy, because my Spanish is for, well, you know. Día is masculine. See, there I go thinking. I see an A on the end of a word, and it's the old Latin thing. I got an A on the end of the word, I got a feminine noun, so it should be, but it ain't. It's El Día de los Muertos. Yeah. If you've ever seen the great, and one of my favorites that I've mentioned along the way, the great, great, great 1978 comedy with Peter Falk and Alan Arkin, The In-Laws, which I think is one of the greatest comedies of all time. You might recall the monologue that Peter Falk delivers about his time working as a consultant in Central America. Every time I see the word muertos, I can't help but think about it, because it's just so classic. Yeah, and of course I don't have it there, but what's the line? The natives, these flies are protected under the Guacamole Act of 1917, so there's sadly very little you can do about them. You must understand the pathetic quality of seeing these giant tsetse flies flapping their wings into the sunset with these little native babies clutched in their beaks. The natives have a word for them. Los Egrecos Los Muertos. Flamenco dances of death. Like I said, don't be fooled and fall for the really, really incredibly, almost unutterably bad remake as done by Michael Douglas and Albert Brooks. It's profoundly unfunny. But if you get a chance, yes, The In-Laws, 1978, Peter Falk, Alan Arkin, Nancy Dessau, pure genius. Pure genius. And, I refer to it from time to time because there's some valid economic commentary in it, because if you recall, the whole plot centers on a Central American dictator's attempt to subvert the currency. Really? The currency? Imagine that, a currency issue. No, really. It's a little bit like this. Well, this is a little segment.
You've got a collapse of confidence in the currency. People are going to panic.
Yeah.
There's going to be gold riots, atonal music, political chaos, mass suicide, right?
Yeah.
It's Germany before Hitler. You can see that.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know,
Jesus. I don't know what people are going to do when a six-pack of Budweiser costs $1,200.
Oh, that'll be off?
Yeah, and I don't know how far we are from that. Especially in light of the fact that Budweiser was purchased by InBev, which is, of course, a Belgian company measured in euros. Oops. Oh, okay, I'm being corrected. See, I mix up all my silly Orthodox and Roman Catholic ideology. First of November is All Saints Day. The 2nd of November is All Souls Day. Saints, souls, tomato, tomato, potato, potato. Let's call the whole thing off, right? What November the 1st is for me, though, more than anything else, is my father's birthday. He would have been 87 years old today. So we've all tried to remember him fondly today, with the understanding that memory is the only form of immortality that humanity has to offer. What we remember of those we love is how those we love live on. So, hi, Dad. He's manifested himself several times today, just to let you know. One of the my father was, I guess, congenitally opposed to a clean white T-shirt. For no sooner would he get one on than he would dump coffee on it, spaghetti sauce. You know, something would go down the front of his clean white T-shirt. And I kid you not, today, and it's not intentional, and it's something that it's something that runs through the family. It happens all the time, but when it happens today, it's especially special. I'm forever just dumping stuff down the front. I guess I'm a slob. I don't know. Maybe we've got the slob gene or something. My father would actually, you know, he looked like something out of The Godfather. We'd sit in a restaurant, he'd take his napkin and tuck it into the top of his shirt. Prudent, you know. But every one of us today has dribbled something down the front of our shirt, and when we do, Kenneth! Because that's what he would say. He'd splatter something on the front of his shirt, and he would talk to him and say, Kenneth! So, yeah, we're remembering Dad. But really, I thought Halloween was over. It apparently is not, by any stretch of the imagination. There was all kinds of, there is craziness inside, well, and, you know, when it's inherent in the process, you know. But no, craziness inside of the repig-licking world. First off, I want props. I want to, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's time for me to take the prophecy wizard magic robe with the frayed moon and stars on them to the cleaners and get it polished up a little bit, because I'm getting just a little too good at this. I want props. If you were listening last night, you heard me say, I forget who I was talking with, but mentioning the fact that it would not be long before all of Herb Cain's can't keep his hands to himself, sexual harassment problems were blamed on liberals, and that the phrase high-tech lynching would be used. Now, to be fair, I didn't get it completely right, but prophets seldom do. It's all in the interpretation, right? And last night I suggested that Flush Flimball would be on the air and say, my friends, this is another high-tech lynching, just like what they tried to do to Clarence Thomas. The only problem was, it wasn't Flush Flimball. I missed it by a guy. I had the wrong guy. Because it turns out it wasn't Flush Flimball who said it first. It was Mann Coulter. But, yeah, he went there. Referring to the fact that back when he was head of the National Restaurant Association, Herb Cain was involved in a sexual harassment allegation in which a settlement was paid out, which he spent all day yesterday denying until he turned around. Well, yeah, okay. It was like a Monty Python skit, but then again, there's always a Monty Python reference for me. Did you dress her up like this? No. Yes. Well, we did do the nose and the hat. Herb, did you sexually harass a woman who worked for the National Restaurant Association? No, I never did that. No, didn't do it. Yes. Well, yes. The funny thing is, because they're fundamentalists, in large part, they will forgive Herb Cain. Now, you might recall that we had a $70 million repiglick and grope inside the zipper of Bill Clinton that took years and came to naught but a bit of consensual oral sex. And right-wingers like Limbaugh declared that the flag was falling and facts must have met and words mean things and whatever will we tell the children? On the other hand, if it's Herb Cain and a repig-licking, it's a high-tech lynching. You know, I hate that phrase. That phrase is so godforsaken offensive to me. airing out the fact that an individual, black, white, or otherwise, may have had a problem according basic human respect to someone because she happened to be female, is not the same as murder. But this is an ongoing problem that the Republican Party has. You might recall a couple of weeks ago when Rick Bro-Fro-Mix, Frothy Mixture Santorum, said that being made light of by Saturday Night Live was the same thing as teenage gay people being driven to suicide. No, not similar to, the same thing. And so it is that Mann Coulter and the right wing say that pointing out the lack of respect that Herb Cain somewhere along the way manifested for at least two women in the National Restaurant Association for whom it was so bad that they left their jobs, that is the same thing as dragging a man out of his home in the middle of the night and murdering him by beating and hanging him from a tree. It's the same thing as what was done when Emmett Till looked the wrong way at a white woman and was beaten and murdered and had his body wrapped in the chains to an old fan and was thrown in, what, the Pearl River in Mississippi? Yeah, that questioning Herb Cain about potential sexual indiscretions is the same thing as cold-blooded, hard-hearted, racially motivated murder. You think we've got the perspective on this at this point? Because if we don't, we have a problem, because God knows the Republican Party does not have perspective. Moreover, the Republican Party has a satire problem. And I've got evidence of it. Now, I don't know if you, like me, are a bad lip-reading fan, but if you aren't, you should be. These guys I've mentioned before on these people, I've mentioned them before on the program, are nothing short of hilarious. They take real live, honest to goodness video of songs, hearing Justin Bieber scream Hot Jumpin' Beans is, well, it's special. But they have also taken to having a bit of fun with the presidential candidates. But the problem is, it's becoming difficult to tell where the parody and the satire ends and the candidate realities begin. For instance, just as a for instance, I offer you Herb Cain and the bad lip-reading piece that they did on him. Just, it won't take but a second.
I'm gonna teach you an expression. I quit. Women have a special feeling, though. They got an extra fatal lady shimmer of no maximum strength. You could be sick, pooping out blood, and you'd still want them. Happy Hooch Day. I'm a nice guy. That's why she said that. Breathe on. Biscuits ain't for jam. The people who buy Coke and macaroni salad, let's feed them orange thread. Oh yeah, I got swag. Because everybody needs toucan stubs.
Yeah, everybody needs toucan stubs. At this point, the real Herb Cain is making about as much sense as that. But it gets worse. It actually does get considerably worse. Because there's always Rick Perry. And Rick Perry showed up at a Cornerstone address, whatever the hell that was, in New Hampshire. Was it yesterday? And I don't know if he'd been hitting the Chablis a little, but come on, he's a real Texas man. He don't drink no Chablis. He drinks brown liquor. And none of that Scottish liquor nor Irish liquor. American liquor! Right? I don't know if he was pilled up or drunked up, but... And I admit, I can't do it justice because so much of it... I mean, this guy was mugging it up in front of this crowd in New Hampshire, but even the verbals, even the vocals are weird enough that you'll get, I think, a working sense for just how loopy he is. This is stunning. This is a man who is treated as a what? Yeah, a real live legitimate contender for the presidency of the United States, and in fact for the Republican nomination thereon. And he shows up at this speech in New Hampshire, and it's clear that there is something badly, badly, badly wrong. What do I mean? Well, I mean this. These are just excerpts of his speech. You'll have to go and look it up for yourself to see the facial expressions. But even the vocals don't make any sense.
And your state and local taxes are in there. You put those on, $12,500 for every dependent that you have.
Okay, we've got crappy audio on that. So let me dig this up again. Because you deserve to hear it. Let's, maybe we'll get a little something better here. It's one of the problems with the interweb tubes. There's no standardization of audio quality, but nonetheless, let's try. I mean, there's 8 minutes and 23 seconds of this insanity. And it's just the sort of free-form lunacy that you would expect, from the guys at Bad Lip Reading. Because they just impose words on the lip movements of the candidates that make no sense whatsoever. And there's no sense here. I mean, none. Let me just run out there a little bit and see if we can find the moment. Yeah, let's try about here. Yeah.
You think about it, you know, we spend $500 billion a year in tax preparation. I mean, you know, any accountants or tax lawyers out there, I'm sorry you do, but that's too much money. $500 billion. And my plan is really pretty simple. It does deductions for the mortgage, deduction for charitable. Yep. You keep that in there. And your state and local taxes are in there. You put those on, $12,500 for every dependent that you have, and you know, just pretty easy math. Subtract it, send it in. It's awesome. Why not? The good news is that little plan that I just shared with you doesn't force the Granite State to expand your tax footprint. You know what I mean? Like 9% expansion.
Now the guy is mugging it up, shrugging his shoulders,
heaving himself up on his tippy toes, grinning like a fox eating shit out of a wire brush. And as you may have heard, again, the audio is poor. The laughter in that room in New Hampshire is, to say the least, uncomfortable. Manchester, New Hampshire Mayor Ted Gatzis said after the speech, well, it was different. Perry spokesman Mark Miner described in an email to the Huffington Post, he said, the governor is passionate about the issues he talks about. This ain't passionate. This is loaded. And there's a big difference. I mean, there's, I believe we need to reform the tax structure of the United States, and I love you, man. He's off the wheels for a variety of reasons. You can go over to Crooks and Liars and find a link to Matt Taibbi's latest article about him. Pretty damn telling, really. I forget what the reference was, but, here it is. Into this morass stepped Perry, a tall, permatanned, Bible-clutching Southerner with front-runner hair and the build of a retired underwear model. But the thing that you'll get out of Taibbi is that, among other things, he may have a drug problem. Somewhat, perhaps, similar to that of Michelle Bachmann. Odd that both of these biblical literalists have physical problems of which the Lord has yet to miraculously heal them, and they find themselves compelled to avail themselves of common human medical intervention. Go and read the article. You can start with Heather's post, Matt Taibbi on Rick Perry's struggling campaign and bizarre cornerstone speech, posted yesterday. So I guess it was over the weekend that he did that. Yeah. But oh, Jeebus. So you heard the audio. Now let's go to the folks at Bad Lip Reading. See if you can sort out reality from unreality. Because these Republicans are making it difficult.
I'm bored by famine. I cannot wait for a medieval cookie, a Cinnabon, hot yellow Kool-Aid, and save a pretzel for the gas jets. Thank you. I wrote that. Some do the Olympics, and some defy the Titans. Ice cream. You know, I had this girl who was too ugly to ride, and we were bitter. This princess in a mustache, one size fits all, everybody hook up, babe. You can borrow my CDs. Not one every day. You can try my Kwanzaa CDs. They're not yours, and you don't have to take any of them.
Yeah, save a pretzel for the gas jets, why don't you? Huh? I guess it just goes to as our political process becomes more and more a function of entertainment as opposed to the serious business of determining who will rule this once great nation. Reality and parody, reality and satire, are going to become closer and closer and closer until you can't tell the difference between the two. And in point of fact, Rick Perry already can't tell the difference between the two. Scarce over at Crooks and Liars with this video audio clip.
Understood the importance of getting an education, and after that, just, you know, hard work. And one of the interesting things, Dean, I saw, you know, that Occupy Wall Street's kind of got a lot of attention right now. And this was sent by my son, who actually is not a Wall Streeter, but he's you know, he works in the financial side of things. And it was a quote. And I don't know whether it can be proved up or not. The young man's name was Jeremy, and he was 38 years old. But he said, you know, we got here at 9 o'clock, and those people, and this was in Toronto, I think Bay Street is their comparable. He said those bankers that we came to insult, they'd already been at work for 2 hours when we got here at 9 o'clock. And when we get ready to leave, you know, they're still in there working. He said, I guess greed just makes you work hard.
Oh, boy, that's a real knee slapper, Rick Perry, ain't it? Only one problem. As David in Tennessee, my head writer, noted when he sent this along to me, it ain't real. It's just not real. What Rick Perry was doing there, talking with the faithful, knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing Pig Lickens of New Hampshire, was lifting a piece of obvious satire that came from the pen of Mark Schatzker of the Globe and Mail of Toronto newspaper, you know, the newspaper in Toronto, as Scarce notes in the post at Crooks and Liars. The piece from the Globe and Mail went viral inside right wing nut world, all of whom were apparently utterly clueless to the fact that it was satire. Because, as noted on the program last night, when confronted with facts, a right winger will, I ain't going to have them liberal facts, and I ain't going to listen to it. Right? But when it does fit within their worldview, it doesn't matter if it's real or not, they will glom onto it. Like a slug on lettuce. And just gnaw away at it. But because this works to somehow discredit Occupy Wall Street, well, it must be true, right? It just has to be. As David in Tennessee noted, Jesus God, just give Rick Perry time. He'll be quoting The Onion by sundown. Which isn't that far away, I might add, so, you know, pay attention. They've got a reality problem, the right wing. And it's pervasive and pernicious. Maybe you saw this earlier today. Again, maybe this correlates with the fact that they see criticizing one of their anointed own as equivalent to murder or suicide. The Loudoun County, Virginia Repiglickens sent out an email celebrating Halloween 2011. It was a mailer, not an email. This went through the postal service. It included a depiction of President Obama as a zombie, with part of his skull missing, and an eyeball about to fall out, and most notably, a bullet hole through his forehead. Ain't that funny? I think that's just funny. My God, if somebody had done... Do you remember the foo-fraw that was created, that erupted when a filmmaker dared to make a film, a completely fictional film, about the assassination of George W. Bush? Jesus, the right wing went nuts, and they babbled about it on every Sunday prostitute program. How dare they? You can't. How, you can't. Well, maybe the terrorists are listening, and they'll try it. Ah. Well, in this case, the terrorists aren't listening. The terrorists are the one who did it. Because at this point in time, we've kind of got to come to an acknowledgement that the Republican Party has become a terrorist organization. You cannot look at what they encourage in the American economic spectrum and not see that as terrorism. And I don't want the emails about who, whether the, no, I don't want any 9/11 truth emails. But when, after September the 11th, 2001, Osama bin Laden put out a list of demands, somewhere along the way it was stated that the goal was to collapse the American economy just as the Soviet economy had been collapsed part and parcel by the invasion of Afghanistan. And lo and behold, the Republican Party has done exactly that. Now, granted, they are deeply engaged in denial. It was in the news today, Michael Bloomberg, claiming that the banks didn't create the mortgage crisis. Well, then you kind of got to wonder who did. Let's ask Mayor Bloomberg. Mayor, Mr. Mayor.
What do you say to those people who are part of Occupy Wall Street?
I hear, well, everybody's got a different view of what they're protesting. I hear your complaints. Some of them are totally unfounded. It was not the banks that created the mortgage crisis. It was plain and simple Congress who forced everybody to go and to give mortgages to people who were on the cusp. Now, I'm not so sure that was terrible policy, because a lot of those people who got homes still have them, and they wouldn't have had them without that. But they were the ones that pushed Fannie and Freddie to make a bunch of loans that were imprudent, if you will. They were the ones that pushed the banks to loan to everybody. And now we want to go vilify the banks because it's one target. It's easy to blame them, and Congress certainly isn't going to blame themselves. At the same time, Congress is now trying to pressure banks to loosen their lending standards to make more loans. This is exactly what the same speech they criticized them for. But having said all of that, we just got to focus on how we move and get the mortgage business and construction going, rather than why we got here and who did it. It's just, you know, it's fun and it's cathartic. It's, I don't know, it's entertaining to go and to blame people and look to the past, but it doesn't do anything for the future. And most of the protesters down there are complaining. I think they should be out there trying to change the world and make it better. And that's what we're trying to do in the city, and that's what people in this room are fundamentally trying to do.
Oh, for the love of God. Now it's Occupy Wall Street's fault that they're not out there trying to change the world. I don't know, with perhaps Whitney Houston as their background. I believe the children of the future. Oh, I got an email from News Ninja Gene today. I may be a felon for doing that now. I have to watch the whole singing online thing. But, yeah, why aren't they out there trying to change the world? Clueless 1%er Michael Bloomberg? That's what they're doing, buddy. That's what Occupy Wall Street is. That's what Occupy Everywhere is. And a fundamental attempt to change change course in this country and go and, you know, take a different direction than straight over the cliff, like some sort of Wile E. Coyote stunt. Meanwhile, your buddies on Wall Street are strapping on the Acme rocket skates. God almighty. And of course, it's easy to go hammer and tongs at Fannie and Freddie. Except there's only one little problem for Mayor Bloomberg's analysis. Fannie and Freddie weren't making the majority of the loans. Among the subprime mortgages issued in 2006, 84% came from private lending institutions. In that year alone, 83% of the subprime loans to low and moderate income borrowers were made, again, by private mortgage bankers. Is our national collective memory so damnably short that we can't even remember the guy with the porn mustache, the chubby little guy, lost another one to Countrywide? Where the hell's Countrywide now? You can refinance your home for only pennies on the dollar. It's free money. It's raining money. Right. But that doesn't fit in with the right-wing meme that Michael Bloomberg apparently feels such a desperate need. To advance. Because, as I've said before, I will say again, they are scared. The lobster for lunch crowd, the lark's vomit canape crowd, are getting more than just a little bit nervous. They're not necessarily, you know, nervous about pitchforks and torches, so much as they are that politicians being politicians, they might actually begin to listen to the complaints of the American body politic. Jim asking via email, what did Kane exactly do to said employees? We don't know. We don't know. We will know, but we don't know. But it'll dribble out eventually. Probably shouldn't use that word, dribble. And we don't know because the Kane campaign's response has been deny, 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 and then once confronted with the fact that they can no longer deny, to begin to obfuscate. So it's deny, 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 obfuscate. You got to give Herb Kane credit. When he was asked about it by one reporter, he turned on him and said, have you ever been charged with sexual harassment? No, now would you care to answer the question, Herb? We'll find out. We'll find out. Because this is sensationalist. This is the kind of stuff that the for-profit media tends to eat for lunch. This is the stuff that sells papers and gets people tuned in. Jesus, I woke up this morning to the news, the tragic news, of the end of the less than six-month marriage of Kim Kardashian. Do you know that that story was actually featured ahead of the story of the failure of MF Global? Yeah, we may find that out, Jim, an alien pubic hair in a pizza. The question is, will it be an illegal alien? Why any self-respecting news program, and that therein may lie the problem, why any self-respecting news program would even mention the alleged wedding of Kim Kardashian is beyond me. But there you have it. Like I said, I thought Halloween was over, but there's been plenty of it today, without a doubt. And things that, you know, you miss the good old days. You know, when the Republican Party didn't send out pictures. Jesus, they didn't even do this to Bill Clinton, and they did everything to Bill Clinton. Putting out a photograph in a mailer of the President of the United States with half his skull gone and a bullet hole through his forehead? You know, all done up within the confines of the Shepherd Fairey poster, of course, alongside a picture of a zombie Nancy Pelosi. The Repig-licking governor of Virginia jumped right out front and led the parade and said the thing was shameful and offensive. Insisted that those responsible apologize for their actions and immediately ensure that such imagery is never used again. Here in the Old Dominion. So, that engendered a response, because this came from the Loudoun County Repig-licking Party. Loudoun County Repig-licking Party Chairman Mark Sell issued an apology. Well, if you can call that. He said it was a light-hearted attempt to inject satire humor into the Halloween holiday. Yeah, because nothing says light-hearted Halloween humor like a depiction of the President of the United States with half his skull gone and a great big gaping bullet hole through his forehead. Ho, ho, ho! I don't care who you are. That's funny. And then the apology. This is the grammar, syntax, and context portion of the program. We deeply and sincerely apologize to the president and anyone who viewed the image if that was the impression that was left. The Loudoun County Repig-licking Committee deplores any effort to display, suggest, or promote violence against the president or any other political figure. Time out. Time. Did you notice that? It's a non-apology apology. You know, out there in grammar land, there's this thing called a double negative where you don't never use two negatives in the same sentence because it's kind of like algebra and it equals a positive. To not never means to do. You don't never do a double negative. And that may have been a triple negative. I don't know. It gets confusing after a while. Took me several times to just pass algebra. Just say it. We deeply and sincerely apologize to the president and anyone who viewed the image if that was the impression that was left. So if that was not the impression that was left, they don't apologize, right? This isn't a double negative. This is a double conditional. This is an if statement, which is equally troubling, especially in the realm of apologies. So let's say you're some cracker bastard like, oh, I don't know, Crockett Keller, who runs a gun store in Texas, and we talked about him last night, right? And let's say you're not offended, and you kind of like the idea of seeing a picture of the President of the United States, you know, as long as it's that one, with half his skull missing and a bullet hole through his forehead. You kind of like it. Well, in that case, the Loudoun County Republican Committee does not apologize, in which case it is an attempt to inject satire humor into the Halloween holiday. See how it works? Let me move into the public service portion of the broadcast for this evening and offer this little bit of advice to Repig-lickens everywhere. When you are apologizing for something, particularly when it is as odious as distributing images of the President of the United States with half his skull gone and a bullet hole through his forehead, when apologizing for that, do not use a conditional phrase. Do not use the word if. The way you write this, Mr. Mark Seale, is to say, we deeply and sincerely apologize to the president and anyone who viewed the image. Period. See how it works? That whole if thing is not at all necessary. Except in the Republican Party, it is necessary because that conditional there, that if statement, is required dog whistling to the people who would like nothing more than to see Barack Hussein Obama stretched out all dead, who dream about it and think about it and consider it in light of the fact that they want to take their country back and masturbate over it. All the teabaggers and Klansmen and skinheads and neo-this and quasi-thats and knuckle-walkers and mouth-breathers and stump-liquor drinkers that comprise the Republican Party electorate in the United States of America. You got to put that conditional statement in there for them, because if you don't, they'll say, look at them sissies are rolling over because the Democrats were offended that their precious Messiah was depicted in a clearly light-hearted satirical attempt to inject humor into the Halloween holiday with a bullet through his head and half his skull blown away. What's the matter? That daggummit GOP just a laying down all the time for them lily-livered, sissy, America-hating, liberal, socialist, Marxist, anarchists and stuff. See how it works? Yeah, that's how it works. Pathetic. Pathetic. You'd kind of like to see the fellas in the dark shirt, dark suits with the white shirts and the skinny black ties who talk to their wrists and are utterly humorless show up at the offices of the Loudoun County Republican Committee and have a little sit down with Mr. Marksell and see how well that light-hearted attempt to inject satire humor into the Halloween holiday goes over with those boys and women. Because ain't nothing funny to the Secret Service. I mean nothing. They don't even laugh at Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck. They're sitting there, and Daffy Duck says, he does not have to take me home and shoot me later. He can shoot me now, and I say, shoot me now. And Elmer Fudd blows Daffy's bill off. And you know what the Secret Service says? Duck down! Duck down! They real serious, the Secret Service. And Mark Sell needs a little visit. Because as long as you're issuing conditional apologies, it means you didn't get the message. It means you don't understand. It means that you fundamentally still don't think you did anything wrong. If that was the impression it was left. Mother. So you get the idea. We've still got some, We got some Halloween to deal with, I reckon. Now, one last story before I close this evening's filibobster and we go to the phones. A couple of lines open. Lines are stacking up, but a couple of lines open. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Email comes into Bob Kincaid, bobkincaid@gmail.com. This one's just a little, this one's a little off target. Well, no, it ain't. This one's serious. Oh, boy, is it serious. News coming out of Wisconsin today from the Milwaukee, Wisconsin Journal Sentinel. Just a not-so-gentle reminder that you don't have to live in Appalachia to be poisoned by killer coal. There was a coal dump at We Energy's Oak Creek Power Plant. A coal ash dump, I should say. You know coal ash. Coal ash has all the nasty things that are in coal, only pressed down and shaken together. Arsenic, cadmium, barium, manganese, magnesium, aluminum, selenium. Did I mention mercury? Yeah, if it's nasty, it's in coal ash. And in incredible concentrations. Well, a big old chunk of a bluff collapsed today. That's the way the Wisconsin Journal Sentinel is reporting it. Next to the Wee Energy's Oak Creek power plant, sending dirt, coal ash, and mud, mostly coal ash, cascading into the shoreline next to Lake Michigan and dumping a pickup truck, dredging equipment, soil, and other debris into the lake. I love the second paragraph. I mean, this is a real kick furniture one. There were no injuries, and the incident did not affect power output from the plant. Well, okay then. U.S. Coast Guard Lieutenant J.G. Brian Dykens said, "This is definitely a freak accident." Well, I'm looking at the photo. I don't see any freaks. We Energy spokesman Barry McNulty said, "Based on our land use records, it is probable that some of the material that washed into the lake is coal ash. We believe that was something that was used to fill the ravine area in that site during the 1950s. That's a practice that was discontinued several decades ago." Well, as long as it was discontinued several decades ago, then it's probably not real coal ash now, is it? Now, I'm looking at the photo, and what went into Lake Michigan is black as tar. But, you know, who needs a clean Lake Michigan anyway? And, you know, Wisconsin just doesn't have enough coal filth in it yet. Who's to say that there wasn't a little bit of our world here? Who's to say that there wasn't a little bit of our lives here for mountaintop removal, coal extraction in that disaster? Who's to say they're not burning it at this moment? You know, we could probably go and put a zip code in at ilovemountains.org and find out for certain. But yeah, a little bit of our health, a little bit of our well-being, a little bit of our hope, a little bit of our future is probably somewhere in Lake Michigan. Thanks to your friends in the coal industry. It keeps the lights on! Coal ash. And here's the fun part. Republicans and Democrats alike are scrambling for all their worth in the Congress of the United States to keep from regulating coal ash, which contains incredibly high concentrations of, as I mentioned, arsenic, mercury, barium, cadmium, selenium, magnesium, manganese, aluminum, radiation, to keep from regulating that as a toxic substance. Yeah, they don't want to regulate it. I mean, them more regulations, they create uncertainty in the marketplace. And if you got uncertainty in the marketplace, it's going to cost you more money when, you know, coal plants on Lake Michigan out somewhere near Milwaukee dump a whole bunch of shit into Lake Michigan. Now, that'd just be bad for business. So there we go. There is, in fact, that's our Tuesday filibobster. We will come back to your phone calls post-haste. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. Oh,
it's true.
They got a message from the action man. I'm happy, hope you're happy too. I've left all of needed love, so the details fall away. The shaking of nothing is killing, just pictures of Jeff girls and synthesis. And I ain't got no money and I ain't got no hands. But I'm hoping to kick the planet and it's glowing. Ashes to ash and fuck to fuck it. We know Major Tom to junk it. Strung out in heaven's high, hitting it all the time.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
Total Genius. It's not your mother's soap.
Hey, dude, wait 1 second. It's totally my mother's soap.
Bubble Genius. It's not your father's soap.
No. See, right here, I've got soap for my dad.
And you know what? It's not just soap. Look, it's stuff for my dog.
Holy crap. There's even stuff for all my pregnant friends.
And hippies.
And hey, dude, loosen that tie. Try it again.
Bubble Genius. We got your soap right here.
And don't forget about that body stuff.
www.bubblegenius.com.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
past the hour, and I've been filibustering for so long that I decided not to run the Green News Report. Hopefully we'll run that maybe at the top of the third hour, or end of the second, top of the third, however you want to look at it. Somebody remind me, because I hate to miss the Green News Report. Brad and Debbie did such a magnificent job at it. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Conversation radio is what we call it. It's listener-supported, and thank you very much for your ongoing support. It's the only thing that keeps all of this going, and that's all I'm going to say. So, by the way, before I forget, happy birthday wishes go out to the Horn's favorite Princeton sophomore. Happy birthday, Cassie. We love you, dear. Don't know if you're listening, but it really doesn't much matter if you are, because it doesn't change how we feel. We're just all damn proud of how hard you're working and what you're doing to... Well, what did Michael Bloomberg say? Get out there and change the world. Only he didn't say it like that because he's, you know, not a redneck like me. But you know what I mean. Happy birthday, Cassie. Let's see. A couple of emails. Ray writing in a little bit ago, talking about, goes back to when I was talking about Mayor Bloomberg. With regard to Occupy Wall Street, Ray says, of all possible long-term results of the occupation movement, it seems almost certain it will end in large-scale violence, not on our part, but brought to us by our government. It has already begun and can only be undone by a Gandhi, which we don't have. Our Kent State will happen, but that won't wake up enough of us walking dead droolies, as we are too focused on our hungers and lost lusts to notice we're being screwed. There is no joy, says Ray, in Mudville. And it's all Mudville now, isn't it? Too focused on our hungers and lost lusts. By God, there's a little poetry in that, Ray. Thank you very much. Kim writes in and says, in my last email, I was quite enjoying and laughing along with your words, and then you rocked my world. It is not funny, and I am not sitting here chuckling about the Halloween candy knowing that Lake Michigan is being contaminated with yet another chemical that was never intended to be put there. Thanks, Bob. I'll still be listening, really. Not in my Lake Michigan. I'm really sad at this news. It's not just another person in another state. It is in Michigan, where I live and my daughter and family live only miles from northern Lake Michigan. Signed, Kim. She had written earlier and said, these little emails are really encouraging. She said, just love the show today. You're full of piss and vinegar. Keep eating that Halloween candy. Love it, love it, love it. Well, yeah, we had a little Halloween candy, but I don't know if you caught it. The right wing Fox among, well, Radio Rwanda, come on, had a hissy a couple of days ago. Obama's give out dried fruit for Halloween. Some treat. What the fuck is wrong with them? I like dried fruit. Has anybody ever mentioned to the Googlies over at Fox that raisins are dried fruit? Now, see, I'm tuned in with this because my darling youngest doodle freaking hates raisins. I don't know why. But for a while, we had her fooled. Oh, no, honey, these aren't raisins. These are dried grapes. Oh, really? They're yummy. Then Ferg came along and ruined it for her. No, they're still raisins, doodle. Damn it. Obama's give out dried fruit to innocent little children who are hoping for some high fructose corn syrup to set fire to their little pancreas. Curse you, Obamas. Dried fruit. Probably prunes. Sometimes it's more of a challenge than others to my problem with the straw. Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Tequila, gin, vodka, brown liquor. No! Yeah. Dried fruit. So let's go to the phones. See what's happening. Is anything happening? Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey there.
Hey, Susan.
I seem to be pulling inspiration out of fiction a lot. You're All Saints Day.
Yeah, see, I get lost. All Saints, All Souls.
Yeah, All Souls. There's an author by the name of David Weber. Writes science fiction. He came up with the Honorverse, which, if you're into that thing, is a gas to read. Anyway, there's this one section, this one culture in this universe that when someone dies and they're having their burial service, it's not sad per se, and at the end of the religious part, people start one by one standing up and saying, "I remember." And they recite some anecdotal story about the departed.
Right.
That changed them, meant something to them, was funny, and so on and so on and so on. And I don't know where he got this, but it just struck me as one of the most wonderful ideas I'd heard recently. Just standing up at a funeral and saying, "I remember."
Yeah.
Instead of weeping.
Well, we've done a lot of remembering today, and I know you've done a lot of remembering in the last week or so, Susan, so there's a reality to it.
And, you know, your father and my father had a great deal in common. They were both on World War II aircraft carriers.
Essex class.
Yeah. The main difference is your father's aircraft carrier came home.
Yeah, it didn't get shot out from under him like your dad's did, right?
Yeah. The other reason I called is because of the Rick Perry speech. Did you see what Jon Stewart had to say about that?
Yeah, I did. The bad news is he was drunk. The worst news is, the good news is he was drunk Friday night. The bad news is he's been drunk all along, and this time he was sober.
Yeah.
Tough. It's hard to watch the video and not come away with something like that. And realizing that I'm talking about video on the radio, I am therefore dancing about architecture. But, you know, folks will go and look at it to see it if they haven't already. And that, you know, up on the tippy toes, shrugging the shoulders, head tilt to the side, goofy grin.
I prefer Stewart's word for it, hammered. That guy was hammered.
Yeah. Yeah, hammered, loaded. three white sheets to the wind and a pillowcase.
No, hon, that doesn't even come close. He was completely hammered.
He was lampshading.
And, you know, I watched that clip, and I just lost thumbs. I was sitting there just tears.
Now, on the other hand, let me bring something up because you kind of brought it to mind, Susan, and I appreciate it. The other clip that was making the rounds today was of Stephen Colbert and his trip to Occupy Wall Street.
That one I didn't get a chance to see yet.
Well, good for you. Because I'm kind of done with Stephen Colbert after this. Stephen Colbert, now remember, you know, and I'm just damned well not going to forget, Susan, Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart are the two millionaire elitists who are funny, you know, who poke a lot of fun at a lot of right-wingers, but they are millionaire elitists. They are part of the 1%, and they are the ones who, in late October of last year, held a rally on the Mall in Washington, D.C., whose purpose was to mock us and allege that the people who weren't teabaggers are every bit as bad as teabaggers. Remember the false equivalency rally, Susan?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I do, too. And look at, you know, there's no way of saying, you know, did this have any impact on the 2012 or 2010 midterms or whatever? We really can't know. But the fact of the matter is, in late October of 2010, Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert joined forces to allege that there is no fundamental difference between teabaggers and the rest of us, and thereby gave rise to the hashtag false equivalence. So at roughly the same time that Jon Stewart, whose brother, by the way, runs the New York Stock Exchange, we kind of need to remember that. At the same time that he was making sport of Rick Perry, and deservedly so, Stephen Colbert did a stunt, and oh, it was just so cute. Oh, it was just precious. Where he donned green fatigues and got a black beard glued on and a black beret. In other words, had himself done up, I guess, for Halloween in a Che Guevara costume and went dancing through Occupy Wall Street holding up a sign that said, "End the lockout." You know, the NBA lockout.
Yeah, I can see where I don't want to watch that man.
And I mean, anybody who listens to this show knows that I have as finely honed a sense of humor and well-developed and fully functional as anybody there is. You know, I'm not gonna yeah. Sit here and say, "Oh, how dare he shame the memory of Che Guevara." That ain't the purpose. But what he was saying by dressing up as Che Guevara was a direct reflection on what he and his writers think at base level about the people who are Occupy Wall Street, who are living in all sorts of weather, who are standing up for their principles through thick and thin and police assaults. And right. They're in Zuccotti Park. And so it's just, you know, it's all just a big joke. What is the...
At least Stewart picked a legitimate target.
Yeah, and I mean, but they, you know, they both have a degree of culpability in this.
Yes, I agree. I agree with that. But the difference between what Stewart did in poking fun at Perry and what he did by showing up what amounts to be hammered to a speech and... You know, that's legitimate fodder for a satirist. Colbert doing what he did with Occupy Wall Street, he demeaned it. He didn't satirize it, he demeaned it.
Yes.
No, not allowed. I will laugh with you, you do not laugh at me.
And that's what he was doing.
Exactly. And I don't approve. I don't know about anybody else.
But again, it's one of those don't take my word for it moments. You know, you can go look it up. You can go see
it
for yourself.
I plan on going, but I have a feeling I'm going to probably end up saying several words in Gaelic, none of which should be said in mixed company. But... I wish these people would wise up, because these are not stupid people. You don't go down to sit in that freezer called Zuccotti Park because you're stupid. You go down there because you believe.
And then the back end of the whole bit was that he found a couple of people and took him upstairs to his penthouse suite.
Oh, oopsie.
And appointed himself leader of the leaderless Occupy Wall Street movement.
Oh, God, the ego. The ego. My God. He's liable to get booted out on his tush the next time he shows up. And there will be a next time because his ego can't abide not being up front. So, you know, let's face it, Michael Moore's a multimillionaire. But he shows up, and he sits there in the cold with the rest of the guys.
There you go. You know, Michael Moore's got a Learjet. Michael Moore is part of the 1%.
Yeah.
But there's the 1% who don't get it and the 1% who do.
Yeah, and Michael Moore is one of the ones that do get it. He shows up at like he should. I don't know if he was supposed to show up at Occupy Portland. I don't know if he did. But if he did, he showed up and he sat down and he dared the cops to arrest him. I know. Michael.
There was a post over at Osborne Inc., you know, Matt's site. It was a guest post over there. I can't remember who the guest poster was. Several days ago, I saw it, and it was this full-throated sort of hateful criticism of Michael Moore. And I didn't post a response to it. I'd like to think I've grown up enough now that I don't get involved in fights on the internet, you know. But it was off-putting. And, you know, when I saw that piece from Colbert, I thought, well, you know, is there going to, well, no, we're not going to criticize Colbert because we know he's really a liberal and he's really on our side.
Pardon me, but no, he's not. He's on his own side, first, last, and always.
Well, like I said, it was just a not so gentle reminder, Susan. Of the fact that we are as much funny to them as anyone else. And you know what? I guess everything's funny when you can dry your dishes with $100 bills.
Sure. You know,
there's some class envy on my part, I guess.
There's something these one percenters need to remember. This has mushroomed into it's no longer a protest, it's a movement. When you get into this, things this big, into a movement, you either join it or get the hell out of the way because it will roll over you.
Or maybe, you know, maybe we're just not subtle enough to understand the subtle humor. Yeah. Susan, thanks a million. I appreciate it. And thanks for your kind thoughts. I really do. Those are much appreciated.
Give my love to Agnes and the kids.
I sure will. She's feeling she's feeling some better.
Good. I hope she read that email I sent her.
She did.
A little present.
She did.
Good
she job. Did indeed. Susan, have a good night, dear.
By the way, your daughter has friended me on Facebook. I'm truly honored.
Oh, goody. Okay. Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye now. News Ninja Susan calling from Oregon. Hey, welcome to the program.
It's time to play Stump the Host.
Oh,
Stump
goody.
Stump the Host. What? Since you were playing David Bowie, what guitar is played on Let's Dance?
Ooh. Well, I can't cheat and go to the internet, so I'll have to knuckle under.
Stevie Ray Vaughan.
No kidding.
If you listen to Let's Dance, you'll notice his licks and go, oh. I see it now.
Well, I can hear it in my head. You know, my brain, being an old DJ, my brain is one big MP3 player. And I just went right to that spot. And yeah, that's, of course it is. How could it be anybody else?
Yeah, I always thought it was interesting that he did session work for, David Bowie before he was in, cause it's such a different transition. He must have just been one of those types of instances where, you know, fate just met up with the circumstances and he was able to work with David Bowie, because if you look at his background, it's like blues, Albert King, Texas. He must have made a trip to New York and just met someone and needed some money and did the session or something.
Or, you know, his reputation. A lot of time, people's reputations precede them, and even before they're commercially fabulous, they get it that, you know, they get studio reps.
Right. I think I was reading something about, this is interesting. I was reading something about, Nile Rodgers, who's the lead guitarist and, musical band leader for the band, Chic.
Yeah.
And he was talking about how when he was growing up, and when he was going through bands, and then when he finally made it, they came and went, kind of like they knew the apocalypse had been for the band in late 70s when the DJs were starting to burn the records. And the thing that brought him out was he became a producer for, of course, Madonna and David Bowie, which is the how we transitioned from that to that. And also Deborah Harry, he produced her first album. But the thing that, was interesting about it was the fact that he said that everybody expected the same. He said everybody expected the same results with Chic. You had to have that amount, that money amount, or you were considered a failure. So when Deborah Harry released her album, he was talking about it, and he said he couldn't understand. He said he was surprised that he was picked to do the Deborah Harry, but he said it was because the industry. And this is how the industry works. They just see the dollar signs. They see the fact that, oh, my God, Deborah Harry, Blondie, and the founder of Chic, we can make some money with this one. But they had no idea that when you put two musical forces together, and it was her first solo effort, that it was going to sound remarkably different from that.
Yeah,
and the marketplace couldn't handle it, and then you know it was like they put the blame on the producer. The funniest thing is though, is that this guy was hired. It's like it's your fault. It was your idea. I just came in to sit down and go in the studio.
And you know there are a bunch of those stories.
Yeah.
There's some that swirl around Todd Rundgren, for instance.
Right.
I remember. I was not as big as now as I was then. But I used to be a huge, huge Ricky Lee Jones fan.
Right.
And Walter Becker from Steely Dan was brought in to produce her album. I think it was called The Horses.
Right.
And apparently that was a war from day one to day end. But it turned out to be an awesome record. But sometimes people just don't get along, and sometimes it's a matter of a producer drawing someone out of their comfort zone. And by the way, I just love the way the horn works.
Right.
I just got an email, and here, perhaps with any luck at all, in a matter of minutes, we will have the entire Stevie Ray Vaughan plays guitar for David Bowie story. How it happened, why it happened, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I just remember reading it. The interesting thing about the whole Deborah Harry and Nile Rodgers was that Deborah Harry was so in tune to the scene. She was the one who would take Nile Rodgers to show him that there was life after disco, and they were playing his records in the gymnasiums. They were looping Good Times, of course, with Sugar Hill Delight. But before that, I mean, DJs were really obsessed with that bass line, and it changed Nile Rodgers' perspective because he thought they were pretty much finished and there was nowhere else to go. And in a way, hip-hop, because of that, for people who don't know, I've mentioned this before, but hip-hop culture came out of the way. For people who say hip-hop is music and all of that, you need to understand something. In the times of New York in the 70s, and particularly the late 70s, they eliminated most of the music programs. True fact. All the music programs were wiped out, and all they had were sound systems and gymnasiums, turntables. They didn't have much in the ghettos and the projects. And they worked with what they had.
Yeah, just as we've seen nationally that art and music programs are always the first to go on the chopping block in any school system.
Right, right. And what gets me though about people who don't understand, you need to understand about hip hop. To people who I always have this problem with people who constantly try to say it's not music, it was a gimmick, it's a fad. They saved literally lives. Can you attest to your life that you saved millions of or hundreds of thousands of lives? Hip hop did that. Because if it wasn't for those gymnasiums, ladies and gentlemen, if it wasn't for any of that, It would have been on the streets, and then the crack epidemic, another influence of hip-hop, and they would have been casualties to the streets. And God knows where a lot of people would be today. So that is why hip-hop is so important, because they kept the people in the gymnasiums, and they kept them inspired, and they kept the records playing. Now, you might disagree with the fact that, well, it's not a musician, it's a DJ, but my rebuttal to that is the fact that that was their salvation at that time. That was like going to church for them. And that was their movement. That was their culture. And to prove people who were the doubters wrong, a lot of the musicians you listen to, and a lot of the guitarists and everyone, they were influenced by hip-hop. They were inspired to create amazing songs and compositions, all based on a gimmick or a fad. So that's just a reminder of how powerful culture and community can be in a time of great devastation.
And we give up on our art at our extreme peril.
Well, you know, the thing about it is it's just like everything, Bob. I mean, they don't explain why people are left with these limitations that they have. You know, I noticed so many musicians. This is the thing that got to me about this. I noticed so many musicians who would always laugh. They didn't understand, though. They would always laugh about how the fact, oh, they just got records, and they just cut it back and forth, and they're just playing loops and samples. And they didn't travel back in time why that was. And if you listen to a lot of hip-hop pioneers, they'll tell you horror stories about what happened in the music school system. This is all they had, ladies and gentlemen. This is it. This is why they were in gymnasiums. You can go look on the Internet and look at the pictures of the early days of hip-hop. And why I'm saying this to you is because a lot of the musicians and a lot of your legends and musicians that you love, and the reason why I'm passionate about this, because I grew up in this era, but a lot of the musicians, they were resuscitated because of hip-hop. They played those records nonstop.
Oh, you mean like when Aerosmith got themselves resuscitated?
Right, right. And like George Clinton. I mean, George Clinton's band was all left for dead. And hip-hop, what they did with it was friggin' remarkable. They took every single record that you could imagine that was just left for dead. And George Clinton, they literally didn't have a touring band. And they brought them out. That's the power of a movement that doesn't have that many resources, doesn't have that much money in the bank, so to speak. And
there's plenty in the bank now, and yeah. I guess that opens the question as to, you know, because the question gets asked of everything sooner or later.
Yeah.
You know, it happened with, you know, straight up rock and roll. You know, rock and roll's dead. I remember when. It was claimed that corporate rock, your Styx, your ELO, your REO Speedwagon, et cetera, you know, the corporate rock had killed the real spirit of rock and roll, and then lo and behold, never mind the Bullocks, you know, here's the Sex Pistols, and no, it wasn't actually dead after all. I was driving home this afternoon, and I heard, and it's just so, it's kind of dissonant.
Yeah,
but I heard an NPR interview with some up and coming artist with a new album out. I think his last name is Cole. He's a rapper.
J. Cole.
Yeah, J. Cole, and he's declaring
that. Yeah, sideline story. Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
He's declaring that rap is not dead. I guess he was signed by Jay-Z. Once again, answering the same question. Of course, you know, the things occur to me because I pay attention to marketing and the things that the commercial world does to sort of tweak our sensibilities. I remember when I was a young man, you were up late at night and, you know, KTEL presents the best of the 50s, right? You'll get two, it's a three-album set of everything. And just like, you know, Time Life now presents the best of the 80s. Because when I was beginning to pay attention in the mid-70s, the 50s were a million years ago. The birth of rock and roll was old, okay? And so now with my generation, which really came of age in the 80s, they're hustling 80s compilations to my generation, you know, for us to grow old to. Yeah, I had one of those little epiphany moments, David, when I was in an elevator somewhere, and, you know, I guess I heard Don't You Want Me Baby rendered into Muzak.
Oh, man.
And I just looked at Agnes and turned it around and just started, because that's one of those little signposts in personal existence that says, hey, you, yeah, over there, buying the New Balance shoes now. Yeah, you're getting old, buddy. So, you know, and by the way, you've inspired a couple of things. Isaac just wrote in. He says, I work with George Clinton.
Yeah.
We never stop touring. We are thankful for rap and hip-hop for recycling our music, but, and this is important, notes Isaac, they did not pay us.
Well, here's the thing. I studied George Clinton pretty immensely, and the interviews that I listened to, now you're going to have to take it up with the main man, the person who's pretty much the conductor of P-Funk. You'll have to take it up with George Clinton, because that's where I got it from in terms of the interview. And it wasn't a text interview. It was an audio phone interview. So,
yeah,
I mean,
and then that's what Isaac's saying. Yeah, I work with the man. And there, I mean, there is a lot of that. It's sometimes difficult to get paid for this stuff. You know, I've come to the conclusion, and I think I mentioned it last night, in regard to, you know, when I was wandering around through the collected works of Edgar Allan Poe looking for fun stuff to read for Halloween.
Yeah.
I found the dialogue with Monsieur Valdemar.
Mm.
And it sort of lit up a little spotlight for me, reminding me everything is derivative now. Everything derives from something else. And the question is, to what extent do you get to claim your own work has been violated, copyright? And there's a lot of problems with copyright, but I also stand firmly in the corner of the right of artists to get paid for their work. I support the arts, and supporting the arts includes supporting the right of the artist to stay alive and eat
right
while they make art.
There's a lot of labels out there that.
So what I was getting at is, the J.K. Rowling. I mean, it was hard to, you know, and you're not going to run out and sue J.K. Rowling on the part of the Edgar Allan Poe estate because, you know, Jesus, it was 1829 when he wrote that or whenever.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Monsieur Valdemar is the intellectual godfather of Voldemort. Okay, there's just, and you know, if I sat here and I played He's So Fine for You, and then I played George Harrison, for whom I had immense respect and still do, My Sweet Lord.
Yeah, My Sweet Lord, yeah, right.
There's no getting around it, and it goes on and on and on. You know, Under Pressure and Ice Ice Baby. Oh, no. See, Ice Ice Baby is totally different because theirs goes dum-dum-dum-da-lum-dum, and ours goes dum-dum-dum-da-lum-dum.
Yeah.
Which that idiot actually said. We're at a place where everything is going to have derivative elements, and the question that needs to be answered is, to what extent do you deserve to be paid? And, I mean, look at, who was it? The Verve Pipe, was it? That did Bittersweet Symphony and lifted the Stones wholesale?
Right.
And, you know, here's the Stones, filthy effin' rich, ain't ever gonna eat beans that they don't wanna eat.
Yeah.
And they sued that band into submission. If I understand correctly, every penny that song ever makes goes straight into Keith and Mix and Charlie's and the rest of the gang's pocket.
You know, there's a documentary on it.
But I can't hold that against them. It's their damned music.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. There's a documentary on this I've been meaning to watch. It's called Sample Detectives, and it's about being the business of people just listening to records And they just listen to the records and they find samples that are uncleared and just sue people. It's really a...
Well, I think back, I remember a song that came out what seems like only yesterday, but it was several years ago now. Jesus, it may have been 10 years ago or more. It was called Steal My Sunshine. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that incredibly infectious sort of wooden temple bell intro that it had, that bump-ba-dump, bump-ba-dump, bump-ba-dump.
A click track that isn't a click track, yeah.
Yeah, well, that was, no, it was actually done by being played on something.
Yeah.
That was lifted straight from Andrea True Connections, More, 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 which was one of the seminal... seminal tracks that got the whole disco thing rolling. Now, Andrea True, in turn, was a porn star who probably never made much in the way of money out of More, 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 even though it was a humongous hit. And the band, and I can't remember who they were, lifted that and just ran it throughout the song, and it was kind of this catchy little summertime rap, you know, involving phrases like my sticky buds and whatnot. That track was fun.
Yeah.
But it would not have been the same track had it not had that lifted sample in it. And the question is, how do you compensate the people who are responsible for the fact that you turn out to be a genius on something that you never even played?
Yeah, well, I think that's a big problem, and I think the biggest problem was when this started really coming to a head was you can trace it back to what Public Enemy were doing. They were stitching a bunch of like 20 or 15 different samples on track. They were making it like a dense collage, and people were just going nuts because you can't take that, you can't take that, you can't. And what they did was they changed the whole progress of hip hop through all these lawsuits. And the whole sampling culture, that changed itself. That's why you really only have so many samples in a song, and why you can't sample whatever you want to sample in that sense. But here's the problem with that, Bob. See, the thing is that all it does is it inspires and encourages people just to go on the internet and be like, F it, I'll just release it for free. And then you'll just still have artists getting mad, but it's not really like they can do anything. Because it's just misappropriation. But you're just streaming like an MP3 or it's on a mixtape. And I notice a lot of people, but see, here's the problem with it, where a lot of people, and this is where I take issue with it, is the fact that a lot of these record companies who continue to say this, well, I'm for the artist. It doesn't go to their families. It goes back to the record label. So you may think that they're going to get paid in that sense, and...
Well, how many years did, I hate this one, how many years did members of Creedence Clearwater Revival go without being able to play their own music because the label owned it?
Yeah, yeah. And it's the same thing.
And there are elements in that, and perhaps it's a learning thing for us, David, that the concept of they want it all is not new. The number of musicians who died in poverty or live in poverty or lived in poverty. Because of the way that they were abused by the record company, those stories are so rife or so plentiful that they are cliché-ish. And as a consequence, you know, maybe we just overlook it, but that's been going on for a very, very long time. Little Richard is still pissed off.
Right.
Because everybody ripped off Little Richard.
Yeah, I really don't think there's a clear, concise answer on how to compensate the artist like this. I mean, the only thing I would say is, if an artist can't afford your work and can't afford your sample, he's just going to go around you and release it on a mixtape or release it on the internet, or just play it for his friends. I mean, the problem is you really can't. I'm sorry to say this to musicians, but you really can't control someone sampling you in the age of the internet. Just the way it is. I mean,
that effort is out there. I had an email from News Ninja Gene earlier today, David. I joked about it. Bob singing on the internet, you could be a felon, but it's a fact. An alternate article by Julianne Escobedo Shepherd. Headline, new bill in Congress could turn alternative media outlets and YouTube singers into felons. And it opens by saying, in June, Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat, Minnesota, introduced SB 978, specifically, quote, to amend the criminal penalty provision for criminal infringement of a copyright and for other purposes. And she writes, in lay terms, it's the illegal streaming bill. Mm-hmm. And it would essentially make the streaming of any copyrighted material on the Internet a felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. On paper, it sounds innocuous. Copyrighted material and the Internet have a contentious history, and efforts to curb piracy have conflicted with the concept of the Internet as a free exchange of information. But SB 978 is a sweeping curtailing of Internet rights under the guise of hindering private piracy and just one more bullet in a broader government effort to end the web as we know it and snip away at the First Amendment. Now, you know, if I had to stop playing a song once in a while just to provide a break, we'd be okay. But how far is it from that to thou shalt, because do you remember when the Associated Press tried to do this?
Yeah.
That they didn't want anybody excerpting or quoting their work without writing them a check?
Right.
You know, and what this all is it's a concerted assault on the fair use doctrine. But what would that do if extended to the printed copyright material? Are you telling me that Susie Madrack and Nicole Bell and Carolee and the rest of the crowd over at Crooks and Liars can no longer excerpt and comment on news articles and point out things that other folks might have otherwise missed? Can I no longer do a little grammar, context, and syntax lecture about a quoted non-apology from the Loudoun County Republican Committee without running the risk of doing 5 years hard in Fed time? This is creepy stuff, David.
I know. It's a complicated issue because, so many artists, they're becoming more and more passionate. I read something that just blew my mind, was that most of the jazz independent labels went under because of the rise of the Internet and the culture of blogging and torrents. And that's just like, wow. I mean, the fact that something like that can change an industry like that forever. And I don't really have an answer for a lot of people who are not getting compensated or anything, but I think the alternative is what we're discussing here, to go in that different direction, to veer that way. I only have three words. Most of these artists are just going to have to take the hit. In a lot of respect, that's what they're going to have to do. And a lot of artists have learned that they're just going to have to look the other way and say, because when you get into this battle of copyright appropriation and legal use and all of this, it is a losing battle. It is hitting the weasel on the head, and up comes another one. You pop it again, and three more pop up. I don't know. I don't have the answer for it. But I mean, the interesting thing is, if you see a lot of these, you know, that's the thing, Bob. We talk about this, and I don't think a lot of people understand it. But a lot of these file sharing services, they pretend that they're like, oh, I have no idea what you guys are doing. Mega Upload and Hulk Share and all these. I've been investigating and researching a lot of these places. And they all tie back to the major corporations. So a lot of these corporations, in fact, they're sharing. they do as I say, not do as I do. And that's the problem, Bob. The problem is that there is such a stealthier, craftier motive for these copyright laws that are coming down. And again, there is no answer for it, because the truth is, the more and more, I mean, Metallica found out the effing hard way, ladies and gentlemen. They found out the effing hard way. You mess with the people on the Internet, they don't give a shit about your feelings.
Yeah, was I the only one that was a little creeped out that Lou Reed decided to go and do an album with the Metallica?
I heard it's pretty good, though. I haven't heard it yet, though.
Well, what I read was it's either awful genius, it's either awfully genius or just genius awful. One or the other. And by the way, Michael Kid A, the cluing me in that there's no pipe in Verve, it's just the Verve. And yeah, he's absolutely right. And I'm a geezer. I'm a geezer. I know it. And He also said, glad you remember Vanilla Ice saying that. I just brought that up recently to somebody. Would have had more respect for Ice had he just said, yeah, I took it from Queen. And he said the Steal My Sunshine band was Lynn. One-hit wonders.
I mean, but that's the other problem. When you have so much money, this is the thing that's a problem with movies and music entertainment. These people are forced because there is so much money invested in this project. Well, I think it's my best work yet. And you know you're bullshitting. I think it's my best work yet. Well, yeah, I'm hearing that they're saying it's a classic. Or, I mean, that's what...
It's an instant classic.
Yeah, the reviewers, they're forced to do this too, because they're under the gun, so to speak, as well. And that's what a lot of people don't understand, Bob. They don't understand that, well, why are people overrated this? Why is this? That's their job, ladies and gentlemen. That's what they have to do. They get a call at 2 in the morning and they say, what are you doing? What are you thinking? That review is so off.
But, but there is an alternative, David. There is an alternative. And to that, I turn to, I've stood at the corner of a bar in Florence, Alabama, and tossed back a couple of shots of tequila with him. But I love his music. It's not exactly we're swapping Christmas cards or anything, but I love Jason Isbell's music. And if you follow his tweets, he will periodically opine on the nature of the music business, and he is double sharp. And what he some of the things that he said, because, you know, I think he's made, it's sort of a Horn-esque determination, if you will.
Right.
It's similar to me saying, listen, I know I'm never going to be on terrestrial radio. I'm okay with that. If there's plenty of room on the internet for plenty of audience. You know what I mean?
Right.
And there's a certain amount of recognition in some of the stuff that Jason tweets about, to the extent that he says, listen, you want to be a great musician? Write a lot of music. Work doggedly. Don't make any mistake. This is hard work. Tour your ass off, and you will sell records, and people will like you, and people will talk about you and say good things about you, and you'll do better and better and better until people are tired of you. In the meantime, hopefully you've stuck a little something away and can take care of yourself through the hard times. But, you know, there is an evolving different market, David. There really is.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's one way to get away from some of this stuff.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think the problem though is that the fact that we put such a monetary value, and it goes back to that documentary that I was telling you about, The Art of the Steal. When you put money on art, there's a serious price to pay. And the fact that we put so much monetary value on art over the centuries, it's coming. We're headed for a brick wall. I in this documentary, Bob, they show what it's like when you go to like Sotheby's, and they show the skyrocket of price of the art, and they're throwing around like $36 million, $46 million, $56 million for a painting, and then they would show like the various people who were bidding on it, and it was like nothing to them. Like,
and see,
oh,
I mean, there's a whole nother avenue of exploration involved in what you just brought up, David.
Yeah.
And that is the question of when you've got $36 million to spend on a painting, and you spend $36 million on a painting, after you've spent the $36 million and you have the painting, what do you have? Is the painting some sort of physicalized manifestation of $36 million? Is it merely differently manifested capitalization? And I guess what I'm asking is it art anymore? Or is it the trappings of your wealth?
Well, you know, the funny thing is so many people are so stuck, especially in the art world. I think they've been bamboozled in this respect. If you really think about what a painting and a portrait is, it's basically a mental replica. You're creating it from your mind and you're putting it on canvas. So when people say, I don't want a reproduction, I want an original. Well, ladies and gentlemen, on some surreal level.
They're all reproductions, right, yeah. But by the same token,
yeah.
If somebody goes to a Sotheby's auction and pays $205 million for a Van Gogh and trucks it home to the big bank in Japan and puts it on the 72nd floor in the boardroom, and the only people who can ever see it are the board members, is it art anymore?
Yeah, it's an interesting question.
I mean, what if you know, to extend the metaphor, what if you could buy Good Golly Miss Molly and put it on an MP3 player in the Bank of America boardroom, and only the Bank of America board could listen to Good Golly Miss Molly, and nobody else ever could? Would it still be Good Golly Miss Molly? Or would it have become some sort of gentrified trash representation of the overall avarice of the 1%? Damn, I may be drinking after the program. I'm going places I got no business going.
Well, you know, I mean, this is the problem, because there's so many there are so many avenues that cross into the double standard issue. Yeah, I like this art and I want this art out there, and yes, I think it's valued, but no, I don't think it should have a monetary value. How do you they're going to hate this word. How do you regulate that? How do you regulate this so that art still has its meaning?
I think David, it goes deeper than that.
Yeah.
And where it goes is to ultimately the question of to what degree can the 1% take everything away from us, whether it be concrete and material or esoteric and cerebral. To what extent can they render something preciously personal, be it a musical or physical creation of art, or a poem, or a short story, or an act? You know, the most fragile of all art is an actor's performance, because the actor didn't write it, and he didn't mount the production,
right?
And he isn't, or she isn't, who is being portrayed on the stage. It is only in that moment that the actor's art becomes art. And to what degree does the 1% have the right to determine how the rest of us perceive art? You know, it's vastly different than it was in the ancient world, for instance.
Right.
Anybody pretty much could walk into the temple of Athena Parthenos and see that giant statue of Athena by, who was it, Phidias?
Mm-hmm.
Or if you could get to Mount Olympus, you could go in and see the magnificent statue of Olympian Zeus. Even in the Middle Ages, if you could cross the River Po at Florence and go up on the hill, you could see the David. Because art was understood in large part to be a public thing. But even then, there were people who, because they were part of the ancient 1%, wanted to limit people's ability to appreciate it. There were Roman governors who went out from Rome. See, after you'd been consul, they would send you out to govern a province.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of governors who went out and went around their province and just grabbed up all the art and took it back to Rome and put it in their house. And you see, these are the people who do that kind of thing are damaged souls, David, because they don't understand that art becomes art because of the degree to which others may interpret and appreciate it. To personalize art and to draw it to oneself so that only one can have it is to deprive art of its fundamental purpose. And it displays a tremendous shallowness on the part of the collector. Hey, David, I got to run, but man, like I said, my head's spinning from all of this.
All right, Bob. Great conversation.
Oh, thank you. Great conversation, David. Take care.
All right, later.
Bye now. David calling from Maine, our pop culture correspondent. Another follow-up email has come in from our buddy Isaac, entitled The P-Funk Initiative HR 848 is a Bill. H.R. 848 is a bill drafted by Congressman John Conyers, Jr. to protect and preserve the rights of artists publishing against copyright and royalty theft. We're calling upon all our fans to come together on a mission of utmost solidarity in support of the P-Funk Army. Our mission this time is not to rescue dance music from the blahs, but from the very forces of zero-funkativity that are misappropriating the ownership and copyrights of our most classic recordings. If it's possible to Now, this is deep. This is deeper than anything I just said. If it's possible to alter intellectual properties without permission, it's possible to change our minds without consent. Come to the aid of Uncle Jam's army and discover how copyright laws impact the very lives of our super funky heroes. Do your part to help them retrieve what is rightfully theirs after so many years of corruption and so many casualties. These are gifted musicians whose lives have been put on financial hold over the loss of royalties for decades. Please support the rescuing of this unique P-Funk music that is as historically relevant as the very institutions that it's culturally founded upon. Help us save this indelibly American music, quite literally, from the humanoid blahs who feel entitled to embezzle from so many deserving artists. We need your voice, and most of all, we need you. We are still one nation under a groove, dedicated to the preservation and the motivation of the motion of hips. Thank you for keeping the funk alive. Signed, Uncle Jam. And that is HR848. The P-Funk Initiative. Thanks, Isaac. Thanks a bunch. I'm glad to know about that. With reference to the function of collecting of art, David in Tennessee writing, a serious moment. Well, for me, record collectors are pretentious assholes. Thomas Edward Roberts, a.k.a. Pig Champion. He felt that way about all collector hoarder types. Because it takes art away from what art is meant to do. I got to thinking along these lines last night in an email conversation with our dear friend Jude, and I guess it sort of bled over into tonight's program. But you know, it's all questions of perception. And what and attempts to limit perception. You know, the for-profit media are an overt and blatant attempt to limit perception. You know, if we babble along and fun along and have a laugh or two here along the way, we're doing it in a larger attempt to expand perception beyond that which has been spoon-fed to a largely indolent populace that we're trying to stay the hell out of, right? And God forbid if I'm getting just a little too preachy on all of this. Ron writing in from Raleigh and says, the run-up in prices is not reserved for the fine art world. Over the last few years, are you aware of the run-up in price for high-end cars? Muscle cars and sport cars have risen astronomically. What was once a hobby for the proletariat has become a playground for the ultra-wealthy. And that's the damn truth. You know, it used to be that if you could shade tree mechanic, you could pick up a 68 lead sled of some sort and slowly but surely go to work on it until you had an absolute work of art in your driveway. And you could do it on a middle-class salary. For freaking get it. That's another one of those things that's been taken away, and it's another manifestation of the removal of art from the public sphere. If somebody's going down the road in a 68 CUDA, odds are he's a dentist, with very rare exceptions. Ray noting, Bob, as an artist, art cannot be judged by its owner, and that's the truth. If you ask a poet what he meant in the poem, he'll say, well, I actually had a bad case of indigestion from the onion soup I'd had last night, and therefore, blah, blah, blah. And yet it means something entirely different to someone else. There's a magnificent Volkswagen ad out there right now. I laughed my ass off the first time I saw it. These guys, Volkswagen has the most genius ads out there car-wise right now. The one, of course, being the little kid in the Darth Vader costume. The outtakes from that are precious, by the way. But the latest one being, and, you know, you worry a little bit, when a car company has to hawk its radio as a selling point as opposed to, say, the power of its engine, I'm a little, you know, but I'm a suspicious guy. But this latest Volkswagen ad has Elton John's Rocket Man playing in a variety of different circumstances. And I think there's one woman who's running along on her treadmill with her headphones on, who's screaming at the top of her lungs, riding in this musty mobile home, until you finally find out, because they're listening on the clean, clear, beautiful the Volkswagen sound system, that it's burning out his fuse up there alone, or whatever it is. Somebody else is singing provolone. Art means different things to different people, even if they're not getting the art right. And when the 1% decide that it's only going to be displayed in their boardroom, then they're saying that we don't even have the right to the perception anymore. You know, how many birthday parties of these robber barons have been attended by people paid to attend, not because they were buddies? You know, Jimmy Buffett being one of them, one of the predators. I forget which one he was. Maybe he was the one who spent shareholder money on the $15,000 shower curtain or whatever, threw himself, or maybe his ex-wife, a $50,000 birthday bash and flew Jimmy over to some Greek island. And, you know, Jimmy came over and played Margaritaville and left, and, you know, cool. Working musician. But again, there's this, when you've got a dead and empty soul, as so many of the 1% do, they try to fill it up by consuming things and taking them out of the purview of the people who do not have dead souls. David in Tennessee reminding me, VW ads, don't forget that Dustin Hoffman is a 21-year-old. Did a VW commercial that became the model for the Mac PC Apple ads. Not kidding. Okay, I got to go look that one up. Ray noting, you have a point, but if I could claim the Medici Chapel or Medici Diamond, it's mine. Ray being a Medici. So, a very interesting conversation. Let's take a little break and come back to more of same. We've got the Green News Report coming up, and I absolutely am going to run that. I have to. I just have too much respect for Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen's work. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is the horn. Yeah, how can I not play this? I think I'm judgment-proof. It's Tuesday, November 1, 2011.
I believe, based on what I read, that the world is getting warmer. And number two, I believe that humans contribute to that.
That was then. This is now.
My view is that we don't know what's causing climate change on this planet.
Mitt Romney flip-flops on global warming again.
Mr. Gore, an inconvenient truth. I call it a bold-faced lie. Sorry about that. Global warming. Here's your global warming.
Fox News, ignorant and proud of it. The U.S. Navy ignores Fox News by leading on biofuel innovation. Plus, it's not your imagination. Weather disasters are now more frequent and more expensive.
You don't say. All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We actually do get smarter over time when it comes to science.
Or dumber in this case. Good point, Fox News's Eric Bulling. Dumber indeed. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Des, it's earnings seasons again, which means more good news for the big oil companies.
Yep.
The Big Five raked in more than $100 billion in profits in the first three quarters of 2011 alone, and that's with the billions of dollars in subsidies that they get from the federal government.
But no, nothing for the renewable energy industry. Sorry, it's got to go with free market principles.
The renewable energy market, we don't want to pick winners and losers there. Just give it to big oil.
Speaking of Republicans, the Fox News brain trust is at it again after completely ignoring the climate change connection to the trend of record heat waves, record forest fires, record rainstorms, tornadoes, flooding, and droughts over the last 2 years. Fox News suddenly remembered global warming over the weekend when they saw snow outside their window. Fox News host Eric Bulling used Twitter to say that the rare October snowstorm over the weekend that knocked out power to millions in the Northeast and killed at least 13 people was really just a big joke on Al Gore, then further pushed climate science denial when he got on the air.
Global warming. Here's your global warming.
That was the famous Christmas blizzard last year, but take a look at this. The East Coast getting blasted again, and it's not even Halloween yet. Give me a break.
Bulling then resorted to cutting off his guests who tried to explain the science to him. Again, weather refers to short-term local events. Climate refers to long-term trends in the whole planetary climate system. Climate scientists have been predicting for years that we'll see more extreme and intense weather events occur more frequently. And in fact, that is not your imagination. Freakish weather disasters are striking more often. A draft summary of the UN's upcoming fifth assessment from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, obtained by the Associated Press, now confirms that extreme weather disasters are striking more frequently. From the rare October snowstorm in the U.S. this weekend, to the record floods in Thailand, to the killer Russian heat wave, all of these are in line with scientists' predictions from previous UN reports.
So to be clear, the fact that there is more moisture in the atmosphere and these storms are getting more extreme are precisely what scientists predicted would occur.
Yes, and this draft summary from the UN also warns that scientists are, quote, virtually certain. That means 99% certain that the world will be seeing even more of these extreme and very expensive weather events.
Which means we'll be seeing more of Eric Bulling on Fox News lying about them.
And while you were trick-or-treating, the climate denial zombies that own the Republican Party claimed another victim.
My view is that we don't know what's causing climate change on this planet.
In speeches over the summer, Mitt Romney said he agreed with the scientific community and reiterated exactly what he said in his audiobook.
I believe that climate change is occurring. I also believe that human activity is a contributing factor.
So in his June speeches and in his book, he said that humans were a contributing factor to climate change, and yet this week he said,
we don't know what's causing climate change on this planet.
I wonder if that has anything to do with Rush Limbaugh's attack on him over the summer after he made his comments initially when Rush said,
bye-bye nomination, other one down.
In his remarks over the weekend, Romney also said,
the idea of spending trillions and trillions of dollars to try and reduce CO2 emissions is not the right course for us.
And yet, earlier this year in that June speech in New Hampshire, Romney said,
it's important for us
to reduce our emissions of pollutants and greenhouse gases.
Wow, those are some extraordinary flip-flops in a very short matter of time, Des.
Indeed. Fortunately, the U.S. military is ignoring the anti-science bias of the Republican Party and Fox News. As the largest consumer of fossil fuels in the world, the Defense Department says continued reliance on petroleum is a primary strategic and tactical vulnerability. So, the U.S. Navy is leading the way, expanding its testing of biofuels derived from algae. According to Talking Points memo, the latest tests of a 50-50 biofuel blend in Navy jets and small ships now show that an algae biofuel blend can be used as a drop-in replacement for regular fuel without the need for any modifications to engines, fuel tanks, or systems.
Well, what do you expect from those liberal tree huggers at the U.S. Navy? For more on all of the stories we covered today and those we didn't have time for, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
It sure is damned enjoyable, at least on this end, being part of rolling along and going with it. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. I'm told I don't say things like that enough, so I'm trying to do that more. I've also been told that I'm not very good at getting the phone number out, so let's try this one more time. 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, Head On. 304-658-3333 is the direct dial number that doesn't involve us paying any toll charges, because like we do on the toll-free line. So if you've got free long distance, you get the idea. BobKincaid@gmail.com. That's BobKincaid is the email address. Okay? Easy, easy? Yeah. 21 minutes past the hour. And I wanted to tell you about something, but I'm not sure if it's actually still there. How's that for enigmatic? A link went around early today from yobeep.com titled The Amazing Story of Rob Goodwin and the Coal River Mountain Watch. The original URL, haha. Let's go there and just make it that much easier for everybody. From Free Speech TV, you've heard the Horn's resident optimist Preston reference Free Speech TV on a number of occasions. It is amazing, amazingly good stuff. Freespeech.org is the website under the tab video, and it's a little trailer. The amazing story, in case you wonder. And I don't know if you do or not. Maybe you just take it for granted that that's what I say. It's not just what I say. It's something I say because it is born of long experience and tremendous admiration. At the end of every program, I give mention to Coal River Mountain Watch, the hardest working, bravest people I know. And if you ever kind of wondered why, here's one example and one good example. Over at freespeech.org, which is the website of Free Speech TV, and I don't know where the video's gone. Maybe it's a problem with this machine that I'm using, or maybe it's some other larger problem. But The Amazing Story of Rob Goodwin and Coal River Mountain Watch, a short film about Rob Goodwin and Coal River Mountain Watch, a citizen watchdog group fighting big coal interests and mountaintop removal procedures. They're destroying swaths of Appalachia and inspired by the Occupy movement. We stand in solidarity with those who are protesting corporate power and calling for a more just society. That's the quote. It's directed by Matthew Lee Erlbach. 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 E-R-L-B-A-C-H. If it's there for you on your machine, go and have a look. It's at freespeech.org/project-citizen-sizzle-trailer. freespeech.org/video/project-citizen-sizzle-trailer. It's a great little piece. It truly, truly is. So, a few other things out there. I've got one little question. Well, I've got a lot of questions, but, you know. You saw the all-day embarrassment that was Herb Cain yesterday dealing with the obvious problem that he obviously has had somewhere in the past of making women who work around him feel sexually icky. And that's probably an oversimplification of sexual harassment, but it is certainly a component thereof. And the right-wing response, as I noted earlier, was granted Mann Coulter beat Flush Flimball to the punch, but that's probably because he was slowed down because his brain's been burned up by all that dope. I mean, you know, literally Cuban cigar boxes full of street drugs that would be brought back to him by his maid. If you recall that whole story.
What are you people, on dope?
Yes, as a matter of fact, he is. And so that slowed him down, and Mann Coulter beat him to the punch in referring to the fact that news is being made over Herb Cain's attempt to dance, dodge, and otherwise dazzle around his dodgy past. And there's an inquiry out there about, well, you know, could this possibly be true? He's a Baptist minister, for God's sakes. I saw an editorial in the local news rag. Well, it's not even a newspaper, the Beckley Register Herald. It's more of a low-rent birdcage liner. Nothing but unapologetic shilling for the coal industry right-wing cartoons on the editorial page. It's just a disgusting thing. But there was, what's his name? Jay Ambrose, I think, had a column in this morning's paper talking about the fact, and he's a syndicated columnist of some sort, talking about what a great guy Herb Cain is. Yeah. And how he's just so genuine and a Baptist minister, and you can just tell how straightforward he is. You know, get going with the tinny piano in the background and Mr. I Met a Man, you know. And that got me thinking. The right wing wants to, some portion of it, the right wing, that has not yet figured out that there is no way in heaven, hell, or anywhere in between that Herb Cain is ever going to be president of the United States. They're in a complete state of denial over the fact that this guy is probably some sort of sickening sexual predator. Just like Slappy Thomas. It's being decried as, of course, racism, and like I said, Mann Coulter calling it a high-tech lynching. But these little things do get my little noggin turning, the wheels and the smoke coming out my ears and the headaches and all the things that are associated with me trying to cognate. And I got to thinking back about something. In connection to the whole idea, well, yeah, Herb Cain could never possibly sexually harass someone. He's a happily married man, and he's got children, and he's a Sunday school teacher and a Baptist minister and sings in the choir and kisses babies and shakes hands and shakes babies and kisses hands. And how could he ever possibly sexually harass someone? As the bard said so much better than any of us have ever said ourselves, and thus we continue to quote him, what's past is prologue.
paid for by America's tax.
The night's still young. Come on, let's head to the river and try out the slots.
Nah, I gotta get home. I promised Kathleen I'd help the kids with their homework.
You know, the Army really changed you.
War does that. It makes you value what you're fighting for.
So I suppose you want me to vote Republican, like you and your soldier buddies.
Not at all. You've got no reason to.
How's that?
Well, you don't work for a living, so what do you care about keeping taxes low?
Hey, that's cold.
You cheat on your wife, so why would you want an amendment to protect marriage?
Hey, a man's gotta do what a man's gotta do.
And I know you're not going to enlist to defend your country.
Not everyone's as slow as you are, bro.
If you make a little mistake with one of your hoes, you'll want to dispose of that problem. Too sweet, no questions asked.
No, right? No, now that's too cold. I don't snuff my own seed.
Huh? Really? Well, maybe you do have a reason to vote Republican.
Yeah, the preachy guy, the deeper voiced guy. That's actually the voice of Herb Cain. The one who says, and if you make a little mistake with one of your hoes, you will want to dispose of the problem toot sweet, no questions asked. That's right. The guy who refers to women as hoes in this seedy, slimy, nasty, vile, disgusting, perverted, twisted, right-wing ad is Herman Cain. And Herm used his own money, spending $1 million to air this ad in 2004 and 2006 on radio stations that were deemed to be speaking to a predominantly black audience. Did you catch all the stereotypes in there? You don't work for a living, so you got no interest in keeping taxes low. You never served in the military, so you don't care about your country. And well, if you make a little mistake with one of your hoes, you'll want to dispose of the problem toot sweet, no questions asked. A man who has some degree of respect for women would not read that line in a commercial. Especially in a political commercial. Politics being the seamiest and dirtiest and sleaziest and nastiest side of marketing that the American commercial sector has yet developed. So the guy, just to make sure that we're not missing anything here, the guy that the right wing can't imagine sexually harassing someone is the guy who referred in a radio commercial, referred to women as hoes. Now, this is just a little clue going out to the for-profit media. Maybe they might want to do a little investigating along those lines. Yeah, that radio spot drew an immediate "what the" from our buddy Isaac with one of your hoes. What would happen if it turned out that the voiceover artist in that piece had been a white man doing dialect? There would have been a massive outcry of bigotry and racism and misogyny, and all deservedly so. See, this, I mean, this, the, this story turned out to be a function of investigative journalism. Herb was not proud to note that he had been that guy, but some digging around and some inconvenient documents did shed light on the fact that he paid $1 million out of his own pocket to pump that filth into the ears of presumably black or African-American listeners. Because, you know, that's how they talk. Because remember, Herb is an old fart. I mean, we've already established this evening that at the tender age of 48, I'm a geezer, okay? Herb is an uber geezer. There's something almost Devo-esque about that ad, as though it is trying just a little too hard to be hip. But there's no getting around the fact that, you know, do a little more digging. Who wrote the dialogue? Whose idea was including hose in that 60-second spot? Herb was a spokesman for this whole movement in 2004 and 2006. In one of them, he repeated the filthy meme that Democrats want to kill black babies. You know, that one has resurfaced of late with him arguing that Planned Parenthood was an outright attempt at genocide on the part of liberals. But then again, there's nothing new in that. They've been hooting and hollering that for eons now. Some news out of, well, no, maybe we'll save that for tomorrow. Yeah, let's do. We will. We'll get that. We'll get to that story tomorrow. No. Some good news. You know, I mentioned good news out of Tennessee the other evening with the hotel down there refusing to host the anti-Islamic hate mongers, Pamela Geller, Frank Gaffney, Gopher from the Love Boat. And that was a good thing. Then last night we made mention of the fact, or we discussed the fact, that Governor Bill Haslam, governor of the state of Tennessee, has proven himself to have a little bit of a fascistic, ham-fisted problem with these constant orderings of arrests at Occupy Nashville on the grounds of the Capitol there. And mention being made that there was a magistrate or a judge who kept turning down the cops and correcting the cops. And keeping the and telling the cops they couldn't just run in and arrest people for the hell of it. And the fact that it will eventually cost the taxpayers of the state of Tennessee a great deal of money. Once these civil rights violation lawsuits that will inevitably spring from this are settled. Well, another little bit of good news out of the state of Tennessee. A reminder that sometimes, once in a while, once in a very great while, the justice system lives up to its billing and works as it is supposed to. It's pretty inspiring, really. The Associated Press writing, Tennessee officials agreed Monday, being yesterday, to stop enforcing a new curfew used to dislodge Occupy Nashville protesters from the grounds around the Capitol. The protesters went to federal court seeking a temporary restraining order against Governor Bill Haslam, arguing the curfew and arrests of dozens of supporters violated their rights to free speech and freedom of assembly. State Attorney General's Office Senior Counsel Bill Merritt announced at the beginning of a hearing before Judge Alita Trauger that the state would not fight efforts to halt the policy. The judge said she had already decided to grant the restraining order because the curfew was a, and this is an important phrase, clear prior restraint on free speech rights. You see, prior restraints on free speech are deemed to be really, really, really nasty things where the First Amendment is concerned. Prior restraints are to be given credence only in the most extreme of circumstances, if I recall my First Amendment law correctly. Judge Trauger said, I can't think of a more quintessential public forum than Legislative Plaza. Bill Haslam's state police had been put into action to arrest 29 protesters early Friday and 26 people early on Saturday. In both instances, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, a Nashville magistrate refused to jail the protesters, saying the state didn't have probable cause to arrest them and they were released with citations. This is good news. It's extremely good news coming from a state like Tennessee. I wonder if a judge in a place like Alabama, Georgia, or Mississippi would have the same nerve. And I think you probably, as well as I, have a pretty good idea of what the answer would be. Okay, I've got the geography wrong, David in Tennessee tells me. Hold on, Bob, it's not the grounds of the Capitol, it's across the street in Legislative Plaza, the one that has dedicated to the people of the state of Tennessee on the dedicating plaque. P.S. See, in some ways not yet corrupted by RIPIGS, Tennessee still works. Among the southern states, Tennessee is among the most special because it was the third state admitted to the Union after the original 13. It has a little more history. And it's not the same old, tired old history of plantations and oppression, although that was certainly there, that obtains in some of the deeper southern states. Alabama, for instance, was bloodshed from its beginning until its present. Alabama has always been a killing ground. As the first peoples who lived there were driven out to be replaced by plantationers, planters, if you will, and the slave culture that they had to have to support their 1% way of life. You know, I'm really grateful to whoever or whatever committee or consensus group came up with the idea of the 1%. I mean, we've known what these percentages were for quite some time. But to really put it into the common parlance has extreme value because it gives us a vantage point, not just of the present, but of the past as well. The 1% have always been the problem in this country. Always. They made some contributions. Jefferson, Franklin, Washington, Hamilton, that crowd were all members of the 1%. I can't forget what John Kaminsky said, and he said it with no ill intent during the PRISM Summer Academy, that you can't get around, at least inquiring, to what degree the institution of slavery and the fact that these white guys had leisure time and didn't have to sweat work earned by the sweat of their brows every day of the week, to what degree the institution of slavery providing them with leisure time led to the philosophical underpinnings of the revolution and the creation of the United States. But the United States was created by the 1%. If you go back in the PRISM lecture series and you hear the story of the Revolutionary War bonds being bought up by wealthy speculators for pennies on the dollar from Revolutionary War veterans and then becoming fabulously wealthy and whose progeny in many instances remain fabulously wealthy to this day. You understand the long-term role of the 1% in American culture. I mentioned some time back that I read that David Crockett biography. It was quite enlightening. And the story both of him and his father is the story of the constant effort to get out from under crushing debt. You know, we tend to think of frontier America as this place where people went and cleared out a plot of ground, built a little cabin, raised some corn, Johnny Appleseed came through and planted the apple trees, yada, 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 yada. And they were free yeoman farmers, right? Living by the sweat of their brow off the fruits of the land and establishing a democracy on the frontier. Cue the fife and drum corps. B.S. If you read the biography of David Crockett, you will find out that he spent his entire life trying to go somewhere that he would not be eaten alive by debt, because everywhere he ever went, even though it was unsettled ground, was already owned by some land speculator back east, who may never have even seen it. The control of real estate and the abuse of real estate and the manipulation of real estate have always been a part of the process, of the fabric of our body politic in this country. And at no time has anyone ever been able to get a handle on it. For a lot of that time, they thought it was just the natural order of things. But here in the early decades of the 21st century, maybe we're beginning to get an idea that it is pernicious. Indeed. Andy writing in. He says, Herb Cain's kick-down, kiss-up management style. Short and sweet. That style comes from a man who dehumanizes those below him in the corporate hierarchy, but idolizes those above him. A man you would never want to work for. Yeah, I'll take a pass. Kim, by the way, careful how you throw around that old geezer line, youngin, at 48. What's a geezer in your world? I surely hope you don't define old geezer as someone over the 80 mark. Or I hope you do define geezer as someone over the 80 mark. No, I don't think you can, Kim, I don't think you can attach a numerical age to geezerhood. Geezer is a function of being disconnected from the present. In many ways, I think, for all I loved him, my father started working on his geezerhood somewhere just short, just before the Beatles' arrival in the United States. He really wasn't okay with Elvis either. Musically, I think about the craziest my dad got was Perry Como. You get the idea. The music that defined his life was the music that he heard piped through some sort of industrialized speaker in the bowels of an aircraft carrier's propulsion unit somewhere between 1943 and 1946. And the music that he heard from 1946 to maybe the mid-50s. He loved the penguins and the platters. He loved Nat King Cole. Drew the line at Elvis and the Beatles. And that's, you know, that's geezerhood. Randall asking a question. With all of this real estate bank fraud going on and the fraudulent paper mills, why would anyone even think of trying to sign a mortgage? And that's a very good question. Why would you indebt yourself in such tremulous times? Ultimately, there are long-term repercussions to all of this that we have, that as mentioned last night in my conversation with Sandra, I don't think we've begun to contemplate. What happens to auto manufacturers when the credit dries up? Because nobody's sitting around out there with $30,000 to go buy a new Impala. What happens to home sales? New home sales? Dries up. How many people does that put out of work? That's a lot of people involved. You know, what happens when people can't go to big box stores anymore and buy the new, LG refrigerator with 17 doors and hot and cold running champagne? What happens? Bad things happen. And we're just bumping right along. David in Tennessee responding to Andy's description of Herb Cain. That is so spot on. The big corporations were always on the look for a hatchet man. Always. They need that guy to keep the blood off the board type's hands. I speak, says David in Tennessee, from experience. And I guess I will indulge myself in one little moment of my own geezerdom. And I will simply ask, whatever happened to the good old days when beauty pageant contestants were just generally silly and unintelligent? I mean, this is... Oh, dear God, 2006, 2007, she is utterly unforgettable and adorable in her dizziness.
Recent polls have shown a fifth of Americans can't locate the U.S. on a world map. Why do you think this is?
I personally believe that U.S. Americans are unable to do so because some people out there in our nation don't have maps, and I believe that our education, like such as in South Africa and the Iraq, everywhere like such as, and I believe that they should, our education over here in the U.S. should help the U.S. Or should help South Africa and should help the Iraq and the Asian countries, so we will be able to build up our future for our children.
Thank you very much, South Carolina.
Yes, thank you very much, South Carolina. I never tire of that clip. But really, just as recently as 2006, 2007, Miss Teen South Carolina, you know, that was as... Yeah, she was just a little, you know, she was nervous and scared and excited and blonde. Okay, I'll get email. I take it back. I used to be a blonde. We've heard me do math on the fly. It's not like I'm criticizing somebody else. I'm that way, too. But that was then, and this is now. What do I mean? Well, this. The days of delightful and dizzy are gone, I guess. From the same state that gave you the... artistic image of the President of the United States with half his skull gone and a bullet the hole through his forehead, the Old Dominion, comes the story of Miss Virginia Nikki Poteet. Now let's just get it out of the way right now that You're never going to hear of Miss Nebraska or Miss North Dakota or Miss Montana or Miss Idaho or Miss Michigan or Miss Rhode Island Nikki Poteet. No, you're only going to get Nikki Poteet from South Carolina, Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, etc. But no, this is the story of Miss Virginia Nikki Poteet. 24-year-old bearer of the essence of beauty and young womanhood for the Old Dominion. And a competitor in the Miss USA pageant. It would appear there was a party at her home in Richmond this past Saturday night. She has a gay roommate. And the gay roommate was having a party October 29th, Saturday. The gay roommate's name is Derek Powell. Derek has been Nikki Poteet's roommate since January 2011. He said that she became extremely violent and physical and proceeded to call me and my boyfriend faggots and cocksuckers at around 2 a.m. at their group house in Richmond, Virginia. Miss Virginia USA Nikki Poteet has denied the allegations. Some of that has to do with the fact that she probably can't remember it. Miss Virginia USA Nikki Poteet was falling down, commode hugging drunk, if you know what I mean. Derek Powell, describing her simply as extremely intoxicated, said she was upset that she didn't have the full house to herself. She lashed out at Mr. Powell, his boyfriend Chris, their friends, and swung her shoes at them, pushed people. Thought you know who I am. I'm Miss Virginia USA Nikki Poteet. I'll beat you with my Manolo Blahniks. I have lovely feet. And you know what? I'll get my boyfriend to beat your ass. She kneed another party guest, tore the door off a family heirloom, probably a three-legged moss-covered family credenza, and, quote, downgraded people based on their physical appearance and economic status. Well, you're just poor white trash, aren't you? That takes in physical appearance and economic status. I'm not saying she said that, but it sounds right. Derek Powell continued and said, "It's the first I've ever been subjected to hateful words and things like that based on people's sexuality." Really, Derek? God bless you. You have led a charmed life. "It just got me infuriated," he said. "Someone like her, who's supposed to be a role model for young girls, to say things like that. People need to be held accountable for their words and their actions." She said, "Derek Powell just wants to raise attention. I like gay people, and I knew he was gay when I first moved in with him. The guy that's in my pageant office is gay, and he's my best friend in the world. I talk to him every day. Some of my best friends are gay." Okay, the last part was not me. It was not her. That was me. She said she didn't break a door and said, "Well, anybody can take a picture of a broken door." Oh, honey, go back and study. You know, I suggest you start talking about the U.S. Americans. Any U.S. American can take a picture of a broken door. She bailed out on the conversation after Think Progress got hold of her tweets, or her text messages. Now, of course, I'm sure she is a darling of the right-wing radio circuit. They love this kind of stuff. They just eat it up. So it's time to get out of here. Thanks, everybody, for a wonderful Tuesday night. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. We'll be back tomorrow night for prayer meeting Wednesday. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. Lottie in the chat room, Sparky in the chat room, our news ninjas Gene and Susan, our blogger Texas Betsy, our op-ed columnist Reverbo, my head writer David in Tennessee, John Fox, who maintains the website and all the technical gizmodery around here, and Ben Birch, without whom there would be no horn. WhiteRoseSociety.org, and of course, abundant and ongoing thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. Be a part of Coal River Mountain Watch and help end, bring to an end the Appalachian apocalypse. And always, 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 Gina, cutie, it's all for you. Rick Smith is next, only on the horn.